I'm with Jack Wyckoff, researcher into all kinds of interesting phenomenon. I'm in the United States, and Mr. Wyckoff has done very interesting research into National Socialism and the occult. Now, what can you tell us about the goofy stories that are out there and your research trying to separate the wheat from the chaff? What's the story about this National Socialism and the occult?
Well, I started off by researching the history of National Socialism in the years after World War I, particularly in Munich. There was a real mix of different types of people, and the Reds had taken over in Munich, and a weird coalition of nationalists and other elements were trying to resist the Reds with the paramilitary units and what have you. And Adolf Hitler came into this mix working for the army, and he traveled around to different groups, and he would go to these meetings and find out what they were saying. And one of the groups he went to was something called the Chula Society. And these were a group of people interested in a wide variety of nationalist and German history issues. They were interested in standing stones and runes and ancient buildings and the hidden messages in heraldic devices and other symbols in ancient and medieval and modern German history.
What do we know about the founders of the Chula Society? What kind of men and women were they?
The Chula Society was actually it was a organization for working class activists to come and discuss political and social issues of interest to nationalists. Behind the Chula Society was a quasi-Masonic organization called the Germanen Order, or the German Society. And the character of this society was that they took Masonic rituals and made them, they attempted to Germanicize them. So the different rituals were done with bear skins and horns and all those kinds of trappings. And Hitler actually was rather sarcastic and critical of them in Mein Kampf. But the power and the appeal of the Chula Society was that they had many wealthy backers at a time when Munich and all of Bavaria was in a very, very good chance of going totally communist. And the civil war and murders and violence that took place in Russia was really going to happen in Germany.
In other words, isn't that some benign Marxist philosophical struggle that we aren't used to in North America? We are here talking about taking hostages and killings and in arson and bombs and all that,
And several well-known members of the Chula Society were kidnapped by Marxists and then were assassinated, which was an event which, sort of like the Valentine's Day massacre, it really galvanized the entire city. And that was when the nationalists, they weren't just nationalists, there were social democrats who were so concerned that anarchy was going to engulf all of Bavaria that they supported any factions which would restore some order. And they did. They marched into Munich and they restored order quickly and rather brutally. And the Red Revolution was overthrown and Germany was spared the fate of what happened in Russia.
People like this revolution was led by men like Kurt Eisner, I believe.
Yes.
a wild-looking
yes.
character, and people like Sobel's son.
Uh-huh.
And there's the story that Eisner declared war on Switzerland, actually, during that time, because Switzerland refused to hand over 51 locomotives to them. So
yeah.
it was the only time that Germany declared war on Switzerland, that a German province uh-huh. declared war on Switzerland.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I know there were brief, there was a brief Red regime in Hungary. There was a reign of terror there that lasted for, I think, a couple of years.
Under Béla Kun, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the Thule Society needs to be seen in the context of German Freemasonry, I think. And to back up a little bit, the church, the Protestant and Catholic churches had always frowned on any interest in esoteric religious matters, because they were concerned that it was going to veer into, you know, heresy or any dissident religious ideas. So, by default, many people interested in occult subjects, symbology, numerology, any number of quasi-sciences or sciences or arts, had to go outside of normal religious circles, and they tended to be rounded up and co-opted by Freemasonry, because Freemasonry tended to welcome occultists, people interested in symbology and the occult and what have you. But in Germany, there were three nationalist lodges beginning. These nationalist lodges came to the forefront towards the end of the 19th century, and they became more and more nationalist, and they did not accept Jews into their ranks. They were only open to Germans of Christian background. And then there were six what were called humanitarian lodges. And these were what we would call liberal lodges, in which Jews were admitted as members. And they had a very strong internationalist outlook. They had strong links with British Freemasonry and French Freemasonry. So the nationalist lodges, as German nationalism evolved and in the events that led to World War I and the disruption of German society, so these the members of these nationalist lodges were tended to be middle class. They professionals, often teachers, all kinds of professions. And they wanted to strengthen their German nationalism in the context of Freemasonry. And so there were the three nationalist lodges, and then there were ones that were even more nationalist, more folkish, in that they were interested in ancient German history, and they wanted a truly Germanic ritual, for lack of a better term. And the German society, the Germanen order, was exactly this kind of society. And the Thule Society, the Thule Bund, was the political wing to organize the educated working classes. There were locomotive manufacturers and workers in the locomotive works in Munich. There were different kinds of skilled workers who wanted to participate in the counter-revolutionary movement, and they did.
And men and women could join?
There were many women, yes, who were members. Mm-hmm. A woman was among the ones, the Thule Society members, who were executed by the Reds in the massacre.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot her name.
That Thule order played a big role in this myth that has developed about the origins of National Socialism.
Yes.
What is the truth about the involvement of the Thule order, or was it the Germanen Orden behind them? Where does this come from? I mean, there's all kinds of books, especially in the English-speaking world, that talks about Hitler and Hess and Goering being members of these secret orders. What's the truth? What did you find?
Hess, Hitler, Dietrich Eckart, and Rosenberg, and others were not members but they were guests. They went to these meetings, and they spoke on different subjects. They went and tried to get the members more politically engaged in what was going on. And there were all kinds of organizations of people who were interested in a wide variety of folkish subjects at this time. So these are the four men I've mentioned, Hitler, Dietrich Eckart, Rudolf Hess, and Alfred Rosenberg. They went to other organizations. It was like a modern political activist going to whoever would hear them speak.
It's like David Duke addressing the Knights of Columbus or Pyrenees, right?
These people will go wherever they can get an audience. And mm-hmm. That was the role they played. And a myth has developed that Hitler and his associates were manipulated and financed and controlled by secret societies, and that is simply not the case. The reason this myth is developed is because of a book written by an organizer and one-time head of the Chula Society named Sabatendorf, who published a book in the 1930s trying to take credit for the National Socialist Revolution, saying that his organization was behind it. And the claims that Sabatendorf made were greatly exaggerated. And in the back of Sabatendorf's book, in translation it's called Before Hitler Came, there's a list of people and places that were involved in the Munich events of 1919-1920. And Hitler and Hess and Eckart and Rosenberg are mentioned as guests of the Chula Society. But the myth arose when a Harvard professor named Reginald Phelps wrote an article in 1963 about the Chula Society, and he made a mistake in which he said that Hitler and his associates were members. And he said that the listing in the back of the book was a list of members. And he made a very easy but serious error in his scholarship, because apparently he didn't look at the book carefully enough.
So they were guests, not members.
Guests, not members.
Meaning guests that had come and lectured.
Right, right.
I see.
And there are actually very few commonly available sources in the English language about the early days of the Nazi Party. So many people who were interested in these subjects went to these periodicals. This one was called the Journal of Historical Research, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
These were historical journals, and there were a number of articles in them about the early Nazi Party and early folkish movements.
Mm-hmm.
And people saw this error made by Phelps and started to repeat it.
Didn't know it was an error.
They didn't know it was an error.
Mm-hmm.
And this question made its way into various magazines and books directed at occultists, who frequently have a tendency to elaborate the myth. You know, they want to create an aura of mystery. So most books on the early history of the Nazi Party and the relationship to so-called occultism is filled with speculation and fantasies and sensationalism.
Now, so this leap of this error actually then becoming the roots of Nazi Satanist connection, actually, if they were not members, where does that leave the roots of the supposed Nazi Satanism or the Nazi occult?
Well,
roots,
to begin with, that's a very good way to phrase it. To begin with, these occultists, so-called, they were studying the shape of timbers in old German buildings to see if they were shaped like runes. They were looking at ancient shields and armor for the armorer's marks. I mean, these were academics.
Hardly the market.
Yeah.
Or the source of,
it wasn't,
of Satanism.
It wasn't naked Valkyries dancing around a bonfire in the Black Forest.
Yeah, yeah,
these
yeah.
were middle-class people interested in ancient German history.
They read Tacitus, like heritage, and, heritage people, yeah.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. So, but the cultists since then, people who read these kind of publications, they want the juicy stuff. They want, and often these publications are anti-national socialist, anti-nationalist, so they want to demonize the, mm-hmm. the subject, and it becomes becomes like a game of 20 questions. Every time a story is told, it gets tall tales, bigger and bigger and bigger. So.
You don't see that it might have been a deliberate kind of moving into a market by people that have an interest in misinforming the public?
Sure, I'm sure that, that element is there.
Because there are so many books, and many of them are quite serious books and expensive books.
Yes.
And I mean, for instance, this book, The Morning of the Magician. I mean, when that book came out, it was a sensation. It was sold by the hundreds of thousands.
Right.
And what, how do you evaluate the book in light of your research? What do you think is the value of that book? How truthful is it?
There's always been a powerful mystique associated with National Socialism. And the authors of The Morning of the Magicians and other works like that want to cash in on this mystique, but they misinterpret it because they're seeing it through their own eyes. And the authors of The Morning of the Magicians were French, and they had their own tradition of French occultism, and they were... It's a pathetic book. It's a silly book.
Is there a serious book? How about this book by this Goodwin Clark, you know, The Origins of Nazi Occultism, whatever it is
called? That's a fairly serious book.
Uh-huh.
That is one of the best of the lot.
Mm-hmm.
He discusses the Guido von List, who was a man who researched the runes, the Germanic mm-hmm. runes. His theory was that before the runic alphabets, which are based on a phonetic system, came into existence, there was a set of magical runes, in other words, a kind of pictographs, that the runes came out of a set of images which would be carved into a stick of wood with a knife. So all of the strokes of the runes are straight lines. They're up and down and at an angle. And so Guido von List posited that there was a set of about 18 magical runes.
And were they word pictures, or were they like letters of an alphabet?
They were not letters of an alphabet because they didn't have a phonetic meaning.
I
so
see.
They were symbols which evoked a visual picture with associations. For instance, there's something known as the life rune, mm-hmm. which is a straight up and down line with two branches coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is evocative of a tree branch or of a plant growth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole set of them, and they each have meanings. And in a book called The Secret of the Runes, Guido von List listed and discussed their meaning.
Now, these runes must have permeated certainly Central European thinking or society, because I know that these symbols, the one that you just described, for instance, were worn by German nurses until the end of the Second World War as part of their emblem. The life rune, in effect,
yes.
was worn on their cap and on their chest.
Yes.
And when German soldiers were buried in the East, they had runic grave markers.
Yes, which is the upside down
right.
life runes, the,
right.
the death uh-huh. rune. Yes.
Now, you pointed out in your research also that somebody in modern times stole the runes, for instance, for the peace symbol.
Yes, the peace symbol, which became the symbol of hippies and anti-war protesters in the United States during the 1960s, came out of the anti-nuclear movement in England in the early 1960s, about 1962. And the peace symbol became an overall symbol for youthful freedom and youthful exuberance and demand for freedom. But there could not be a more magically wrong symbol, because the peace symbol is the death rune and the rune of misplaced sexual energy. And what could, you know, what could be worse for young people? Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling that that choice may have been made on purpose. Who knows? It could have been. Mm-hmm. But it was the wrong symbol. The true symbol should have been the life rune, the mm-hmm. the upright with the arms outstretched. Mm-hmm. And in fact, beginning in the 19-teens in Germany, there was a whole series of exercises in which people would greet the sun in the life rune position. There was a whole set of exercises in which the body took the positions of the various runes. So there was a whole occult science, if you will, to use the term, of coordinating, aligning movement, symbols, colors, scents, sounds, numbers, all together in a manner which would strengthen Germanic, folkish, and nationalist thought.
Do you think that was meant to be a substitute religion, or was it meant to still the hunger by those elements that you said were seeking, and that Freemasonry, different branches of Freemasonry, kind of like a magnet pulled onto them? Do you think that this movement that had the kind of greeting the sun with a life rune shape or doing their exercises, did that have religious significance or more cultural significance?
I think it had a great deal of religious significance. It had a lot of cultural significance. And it was a movement which in many ways sprang out of the desires of the people, particularly after World War I, with the devastation of German society, European society. People were looking around for all kinds of things. And I think that these various Masonic secret societies, these secret societies with Masonic connections is a better way to term it, they wanted to jump on the bandwagon and exploit these youth movements.
Mm-hmm. But the movement, let's call it the runic movement, even though that's really not the name,
right,
was that afoot at the time when the Thule Society was active?
Yes, yes. In fact, it goes back probably to the 1890s, 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
These ideas were all percolating in,
right,
in European society. Partly because it was perceived that there had been a conflict in the 19th century between religion and science.
Mm-hmm.
People wanted to reconcile religion and science, and they wanted to go off in new directions and look for religious significance in other ways than simply than in the church rituals.
Now, did the church feel threatened by this kind of movement? Is it, you know, I mean, the churches have always been jealously guarding their position in European society or in Aryan society even. Do you know if there was hostility towards these movements? Is that why the Thule Society, for instance, is getting such a bad press, or even is being twisted out of shape like some pretzel, you know? I mean, is that maybe where powerful forces in our own society today have an interest in setting up not a boogeyman but kind of a deflector? These are like the magnesium flares, you know, talking that Nazis are Satan,
right,
worshippers or something like that.
Right.
In your research, have you come across anything like that? You know, is there any indication that there are forces at work that want to shut off, so to speak, an Aryan search for occult meaning in the non-Freemasonic area, you know?
Oh, definitely. I think that the establishment, which is the church, the state, and then the Masonic organizations, by the beginning of the 20th century, the church and the Masonic organizations had a kind of truce. They had, they each had their turf. But any third way, third position, which is a term often referred to National Socialist movements, would be threatening to both. And these folkish, these various folkish movements, folkish interests, I think were threatening to the establishment in Germany. I think that they're threatening to the establishment today. And I think that the...
I want to zero in on whether in your research, because I know you have done a tremendous amount of research into the origins of National Socialism, and also into early National Socialism, even though, you know, in the English language world there isn't much material, but you have done research into the German language areas. Do you see in the evolution of the early National Socialist Party in their uniforms, in their rituals, in their meetings, you know, in their marches, are there overtones that there were elements in there that were giving the party, let's say, an occultish direction? I mean, do you see anything in there? I mean, for instance, you're talking about the SS. There were speeches where they called it ein Blutorden, you know, and when they, Hitler says, and the SS shall be like an order, you know? Is it like the Knights Templars order, like an order?
Or the Knights, the Germanic.
The Germanic Knights, yeah. Yes. So, do you think the party had elements within it that were trying to turn it into a religious type movement?
There were many paths being explored. I think that the German National Socialists, who were closest to Christian thought, wanted another Reformation. They wanted to reform the church yet again. And there was something called positive Christianity. Then there were other elements who wanted to create a more pagan Germany, if you will. But not a Germany at odds with Christianity, but to rediscover many of the traditions which actually were pagan and not Christian. For instance, the word for Easter comes from the goddess of spring, Astara. And the Christmas falls very close to the winter solstice, and Easter falls very close to the vernal equinox. So there were elements in the SS who wanted to openly celebrate the equinoxes and the solstices with solar type rituals, greeting the sun, lighting candles, but in a non-Christian context.
Is this where the hostility between the churches and National Socialism has its roots, maybe?
What do you think? Partly, but it's important to know that Hitler was not challenging the power of the church, as long as the church did not enter into political affairs. The church was basically, I think, told to mind their own flocks and but not to rock the boat politically.
Well, they had that 1934 Concordat, which was a kind of a treaty between the Vatican and also the Protestant churches to, you know, clearly delineate what the role of the party, what the role of the state, and what the role of the churches were. But still, there was, I mean, nobody can deny that there was continuous friction and actually alarm in the 30s as National Socialism became clearly the dominant life force. There's obvious signs that the churches became alarmed at the drain of young people out of the church into this virile organization. And you don't think there was anything afoot, let's say? I mean, wasn't Himmler plotting with his Wewelsburg and you know, some of these things? Wasn't he plotting a kind of an Aryan church based on some runic history or symbols or something?
Well, he was definitely creating an order of the SS. He wanted to revive the glories of the Germanic Knights. who had come back from the Crusades, fed up with trying to conquer, fight the Arabs, and they went back to German borders, and they took as their mission protecting the eastern borders of Europe from the landmass and the the Asian hordes, you know, who had traditionally, on occasion, had tried to storm Europe and had failed repeatedly.
Now, you are an English speaker. You grew up in America. Do you find the same kind of search in different English-speaking countries that you found amongst the Germans in the 19th and early 20th century there? Is there a parallel search amongst English speakers for finding not the Holy Grail, but, you know, finding a way out of this kind of what you could almost call petrified or calcified or stale? Even masonry and Christianity had become pretty, not atrophied.
Calcified?
Yeah, that's it, calcified. Yeah. That's what I mean, you know? In National Socialism, I mean, was like a breath of fresh air.
Right.
Now, do you find that there are similar movements? I'm not talking about Aleister Crowley, which was clearly something totally different.
Right.
But I mean, with Madame Blavatsky, for instance, is that a parallel movement to the German movement, or is that something totally different?
I'm not really an expert on Blavatsky, although I've read her books. Blavatsky wanted to relieve the tension between science and religion. And, for instance, there was many Christian teachings would say that the earth was only 6,000 years old. Now, Darwinism countered that completely. So in Blavatsky's books, she talks about human evolution, but also in spiritual terms of evolving, you know, races, sub-races, spiritual bodies, what have you. And it's a whole mix of religious and quasi-religious and superstitious ideas. But it had a great appeal because Blavatsky was imagining an ancient religious history going back millions of years to the beginnings of you know, creation. In other words, she was, the appeal of theosophy was that it presented a much larger, more cosmic view of existence, and it gained many, many adherents.
Now she came along and introduced this Krishnamurti character, which was something very close to Christ, wasn't it?
She felt that the strongest religious tradition to be resurrected were Hindu and ancient Indo-European cultures. But Blavatsky was in many ways a bit of a fraud, and she claimed to have these hidden masters, and many of these hidden masters were Freemasons. So again, theosophical movement is again in the Masonic camp. But there was an interesting phenomenon beginning about 1875 when Schliemann discovered the ruins of Troy. And in the ruins of Troy were a great number of artifacts with swastikas on them. And the swastikas went in both directions. They were some going the direction that the Nazi swastika went, and others that went the other direction, often on the same object. And often these were on these little whorls, which were used as weights and the looms for weaving. And this symbol caught the imagination of European and American peoples. And Blavatsky had written one of her books before the discovery of Troy, and she hadn't mentioned the swastika at all. And after the discovery of Troy, all of a sudden the swastika makes its way into Blavatsky's books and into the symbol, the official symbols of the Theosophical Society. So obviously, this is an example of Blavatsky, the theosophist, jumping on the bandwagon, because the average person suddenly, the average non-Masonic, just the ordinary white people in Europe and North America, were inexplicably attracted to the swastika. And suddenly there were swastikas on postcards, on magazines, on fountain pens. The Parker Fountain Pen Company put out a swastika fountain pen, all the way up to World War I.
And they had swastika clubs in different towns.
Yes, and people put swastikas over the doorways of their houses. And when Kipling went to India, he was fascinated by seeing the swastikas. And Rudyard Kipling, the British author, used the swastika as his personal symbol.
Yeah.
I've got hunting traps for minks with a swastika cut into the trap. I've got little pillows you give your girlfriend with swastikas on them. And this was all before World War I, before 1914.
Now, didn't Indians, North American Native Indians, didn't they have the swastika?
Yes.
Even before Schliemann discovered the gold of Troy, so the swastika must have been around.
The swastika was known to the Indians and to the English and to the Germans. I mean, it wasn't only in Troy, but it was the discovery of the artifacts in Troy
that
and the gold of
that
Troy.
Stimulated the
that
thing,
stimulated this interest. And people suddenly were looking at their own artifacts in the British Museum and the German museums in the United States.
So could you say there is really no true European, Western European or Aryan, for a better word, occultism? After all your research, have you found that there is no such thing, that we don't have the same, but what we really call occultism here with, let's say, Grand Orient Lodge or Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which has its supposed origins as far back as Egypt or Jewish?
We definitely have our own traditions. Occult simply means hidden.
Right.
And the folkish occultist wanted to dig into the German history, the Aryan history, into European history, and find those things that were true to our own nature, not some religion that developed in the Middle East by an alien people. A very good example is the days of the week. So, you know, Tuesday is named for the Viking god Tyr. Wednesday is set for Votan, or Odin. Thursday is for Thor. Friday is for Frigga, or Freya.
Mm-hmm.
And then Saturday is for the moon and the sun, Sunday, and Saturday is for Saturn. So Saturday doesn't have the same connection, but there are elements there.
Mm-hmm.
And in nursery rhymes, when we say Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water, what that refers to is that the ancient Aryans saw two people on the moon, not a man on the moon, but a man and a woman, brother and sister, who was kind of an ancient incest myth of two people so pure, so without genetic blemish that they could intermarry. And that is an Egyptian concept, too. So the ancient Egyptian kings often would marry their sisters. I'm not promoting.
No, I understand.
It was a mythological concept.
Mm-hmm.
So buried in our history we have an occult history, but it's been suppressed.
And you don't think that we go back to these Egyptian, you're mentioning this concept in Egypt where a king marries his sister, brother marries his sister. And you don't think that our let's say, occult roots go back to past Akhenaton or sun worship?
There's evidence that the early Sumerians and the early Egyptians were in part Indo-European. There was a mixture of races in those areas, and probably the Indo-European Aryan peoples have traveled the globe more extensively than any other race.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's a book called America B.C., which discusses all kinds of racial types have come to the North American continent.
Mm-hmm.
There's archaeological and forensic evidence that all kinds of races have been here.
Kennewick man, quite recently 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
And how about the Inca gods described as white, tall, blonde-haired? And so
the earliest, you look at early cultures all over the world, including the Incas and the Sumerians, and they all have certain characteristics. The gods ride in carts. They're often pulled by symbolic animals, like Odin was pulled by two goats. He had two ravens, mind and memory, that rode on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. All the Indo-European gods from India, Persia, all across Europe, even into parts, the fringes of China, they have many characteristics they share.
Mm-hmm. Which would lead you, what, to believe that it was one common origin? That there was once, like, a common origin?
There's links between all the Indo-European peoples. Mm-hmm. And by Indo-European, by Aryan, I mean a wide range. There are the Celts, the Teutonic peoples, the Slavic peoples, and the Mediterranean peoples. They all share a relatively common linguistic, cultural, and racial background. I mean, they've traveled around for thousands and thousands of years,
and
so their races aren't exactly the same, but they're connected.
Do you see in those, apart from the chariots, let's say some symbolism, do you see a common thread of spirituality? Do you know? I mean, we obviously, all these people, we are looking for something outside of themselves. They were all worshiping something. Do you see a common threat, let's say, between the Egyptians are, for instance, under Akhenaten, they're worshiping the sun.
Right.
Now, you told me not half an hour ago about this runic thing where these people made the life rune form with their body, also towards the rising sun.
Yes.
And I mean, no, we're talking Northern Europeans of 1900, and so they say 1910, 1920, and we're talking Akhenaten, which is what, 2000 years before Christ.
Yes. Well, most if not all, Indo-European Aryan religions are solar based. They're based on worship of the sun, worship of the agricultural cycles. This is in opposition to stellar cults. There have been cults throughout history that have worshipped stars, they worship the moon, mm-hmm. and these cults are essentially religions of the dark, of darkness, of the night.
Mm-hmm. Now, where does that set these religions that worship the sun or light, how do they juxtapose to Judaism or Babylonianism, let's call it that, or some of these other Mediterranean cults that we know? What is the difference between them, do you know? I mean, do they worship, have they got the kind of the year divided into these segments? Do they worship plants, life, animals?
They worship, their ritual inevitably involves bloody sacrifice ruled over by a priestly cult which manipulates the people through fear and the threat of sacrifice. And behind most of these systems of ritual sacrifice, of blood sacrifice, is the threat that the people could be a victim unless they bring offerings to the
And Europeans don't have that in there?
Yes. There have been many, many occasions where European cultures have disintegrated and become bloody and cruel, you know, and the Druids, for instance, in Celtic society, by the time of the Romans, the Druids had become a kind of mafiosa who were ruling over the local Celts in France, and you know.
You don't think we're getting Roman propaganda here that you know, demonizes
to an extent? Yes.
Yeah.
But
I mean, the Romans have the only true gods, right? And here are these animal worshippers or something.
But just because the ancient Vikings did some pretty mean things, you know, they did human sacrifices. They would drown people in bogs. So, you know, cruelty, cruel religious practices, sacrifices are not limited to, you know, to non-Aryan peoples.
Yeah.
But there is a strain of the religion of the light, a religion of the sun, and a history of nation builders and reformers who will go to new areas and try to reform the people there. I think perhaps there's a missionary element.
And so how do you evaluate Christianity in this chain, you know, in this never-ending chain of finding new religions
Well, what we call Christianity is really a Judeo-Christianity, is a amalgamation, a synthesis of Hellenic Greek ideas and Semitic ideas, which collided around the time of Christ.
And do you think it's properly named Judeo-Christianity?
Yes. I think the Christianity needs to be reformed and could be reformed.
Are you saying reformed or split minus the Judeo to have Judaism on one side and Christianity on another side?
Because I think the Judaism is inherently counter to true Christian ideas.
Was Christianity a response to Judaism to make it a more palatable or a gentler religion? Because Judaism had become very, again, cultified maybe, or Pharisaism, maybe we should call it, rather than Judaism?
Right. Well, modern Talmudic Judaism is Pharisaism. And Jesus, who I do not believe was a Jew, he came from Galilee. And the saying in the Gospels, one time it said, can any good thing come out of Galilee? The implication being that because he wasn't a Judean, he wasn't religiously or socially or racially perhaps pure enough. Mm-hmm. And there were large Greek colonies. There were many people of Greek ancestry in Galilee and all through Palestine at that time. So there was a whole mix of people. And the term Jew was not really in use.
Ruling. No, we were talking about Christ the Judean not being the politically correct person or coming from an area that made him not quite acceptable to the Pharisees.
Right. Well, obviously, there are two genealogies given for Jesus in the Gospels, and they're both mutually contradictory. So, obviously, at some point, someone wanted to give Jesus a Jewish lineage from David, the royal house of the Judeans. And my opinion is that was added later. But in the Gospels, one can get a glimmer of what I believe to be the true Jesus. And he came to oppose the religion of the Pharisees, out and out. And he spoke with extraordinary moral courage and moral authority. He forgave people, which offended the Pharisees because they felt there was no forgiveness without sacrifice, without paying homage and bringing a sacrifice to the temple. And often it's argued that Jesus was Jewish because he entered the temple and overthrew the money changers. But the temple of Herod had many different areas. And where the money changers was an area where Gentiles went. And Gentiles often would go to the temple to make a sacrifice or to pay, to give an offering. Even the Roman emperor would send a symbolic offering. Because the ancient pagans, they wanted to cover all the bases. They would donate to all the various gods.
It's like the big corporations donating to the Republicans
right.
and to the Democrats at the same
right.
time.
Any donation to the temple, which was made in coin, had to be converted into shekels, the temple currency. And there were these middlemen making these usurers.
Their commission.
And so when Jesus overthrew the tables of the money changers, he was not in the temple proper. There was a whole series of like concentric rings. Only Jews could enter at a certain point. And then there are signs that still exist in the British Museum from that time that say Gentiles may not go past this point. Then there was a point at which Jewish women could not go further. And then there was a point at which rabbis and priests could not go, etc., all the way to the Holy of Holies. And Jesus opposed, in my opinion, opposed the temple system. He was not there to reform it. He was there to oppose it because it was a system of religious racketeering which fleeced the people, and controlled them.
So he was an early version of Martin Luther then? Or?
I think so, yes. And Jesus may have traveled to other places in the East besides Palestine. There's also a passage in the Gospels where someone says of him, he's not yet 50. You know, we commonly believe that Jesus was 33 years old, but there's nothing in the Gospels that say he was 33. That may even be a Masonic, because the number 33 is very important, Masonic symbology. So Jesus may have been much older. He may have traveled as far as India.
Yeah, you know. There are books about it, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So he may have been a reformer who attempted to reform people in many religious centers, and it only happened to be that in Jerusalem, the priests became so angry that they murdered him.
Yeah. And, so you're saying then that Judeo-Christianity is a misnomer of today?
It's an oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms.
In other words, the two of them are, in your opinion, one was a response to the other, like a reformator's response to the degeneration of the other?
Well, they were the result of a collision of two sets of ideas, and the mishmash took its own direction.
So when our modern ministers and priests talk about Judeo-Christianity, it is just words meant to lull or confuse or to ingather goyim, unsuspecting Christians towards the Jewish idea?
Right.
So the Council for Christians and Jews is along the same vein?
I would say so.
Now, so in your constellation, then, the Germans had obviously a religious struggle on their hands then in the 30s. Notwithstanding Hitler saying that the churches should stay out of the affairs of the state and of the party.
I think that Judeo-Christianity had caused this kind of inherent religious and cultural schizophrenia, where anything before the Christianizing of the German tribes was suspect. And the German occultists, the German National Socialists, wanted to end that division there. They wanted to heal that guilt, for the German pagan past. That the German pagan past, instead of being counter the two true teachings of Christ, actually was very similar to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hitler made fun of those in Mein Kampf. He made fun of those that donned a bearskin, he said, sandals, and waved their wooden swords in the Vienna woods.
Yes.
You know, he says, you cannot go back to something that has lost all connection to our people. So, obviously, Hitler was not a fool thinking that he could, or that they could, or somebody within the state could resurrect, let's say, ancient Wotanism.
No, he felt that was not possible. But Hitler was a pragmatist, and he was primarily concerned with resurrecting the German people into healthier patterns of living. But he allowed and encouraged different individuals, the different organizations, to explore potential for a new Germanic religion. So Alfred Rosenberg had his ideas, Himmler had his ideas, but they were a long ways from becoming a state religion. I think if it would have happened at all, it would have taken 30 or 40 years, and then who knows what would have arisen.
Some people have referred to the National Socialist Party as such, as having had the potential to become a movement. It was a Weltanschauung, a philosophy of life, an ideology. Could it be that an ideology would be a modern term for a religion? In other words, are we trapped in the concept of religions when in effect ideologies like Marxism, is a religion?
Has
many of the trappings, I mean, we are seeing the formation of a current new religion called Holocaustology, Holocaust mania, whatever you want to call it,
The line between religion and ideology is very, very thin, and they overlap constantly.
So, coming down towards the end of that, Judaism in Christianity and the Judaic concepts, you know, the that came clearly out of the Middle East. Now, you seem to think that it had its roots in Babylonianism, where they have even the Talmud, the Babylonian yes. Talmud. So has that anything to say to us Europeans? I mean, is that something that would speak to our soul, to our heart? Is there, do Europeans derive satisfaction? Could they derive satisfaction of a Judaistic religion? What do you think?
If a group of people believe that their savior is from an alien culture and race, that the priestly group that would interpret that religion, that revealed religion, is a group of strangers, of people of a different race, different religion, the people that would accept such an alien culture and religion, that makes them into slaves. And the German National Socialists were attempting to free themselves of this yoke of superstition, of alien religious ideas, and return to their own roots, and to sort out the good from the bad.
Do you think one could not interpret the fervor that was shown by the early National Socialists, these mass rallies, the torchlight parades? That was not the stuff of political parties, you know? I mean,
religious rights.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, this is what I mean. Right. Are there overtones that was the church, we call it in German, aufgeschreckt, you know? I mean, it's like poking a stick into a hornet's nest. When they saw these, like the Cathedral of Light in Nuremberg, sure. Where hundreds of thousands belted out these joyous songs and this, when, I mean, in unison raised these arms, I mean, was that not religious fervor?
Sure.
Near religious ecstasy?
Yeah, I would say so.
And is that what possibly brought the whole world down on the Germans, that all these reactionary forces that feared the introduction of something so radically new?
Right.
Because there are some people who say that the Second World War, I mean, there was even a book, I think, by President Eisenhower called it A Crusade to Europe.
Right.
With a crusader's shield. And when Roosevelt and Churchill met, they sang about onward Christian soldiers.
Sure.
Which all would indicate to me that the movers and shakers, obviously, and all of them being Freemasons. I mean, Roosevelt was a very high-ranking Freemason. Yes. Churchill apparently was a Freemason. The French, many of the officers and so on were Freemasons. Marshall.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is an area of history that has not been explored, and that maybe these books that you have researched, you know, these authors like The Morning of the Magicians and the kind of occult Nazism, this almost like laying a false trail, could it be that many of the people are sidetracked and what we really saw there in the Second World War was really an occultish war against this rising new
sure.
thing? Did you find overtones of that? Do you think there are overtones?
Definitely, yeah.
Because for so many Freemasons were involved. And there's also, of course, the killing of the Germans in Nuremberg, you know, on those days of
right.
Purim.
Right.
And the way they were hung and the numbers of steps going up to the gallows.
Right. It wasn't Purim exactly. That was what
Stryker
said. Stryker
said.
Because
yeah.
It was a Purim-like
yeah.
like holiday
uh-huh.
ritual.
And, you know, then giving them Jewish names, all these condemned were given Jewish names before they were cremated in the crematory in Munich.
Hmm.
You know, I think that Streicher was called Goldberg on the papers.
Wow.
And then that they took the ashes and scattered the ashes in a river to be borne away
yeah.
so that there was no trace to be able to be found of them
right.
and so on. Now, is that... I mean, this is almost Nuremberg. There have been books written. They called Nuremberg the judicial murder of these Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Are we looking at Has nobody ever explored whether this was a kind of an occult war against a rising new religion?
Well, there was certainly an element of that. And National Socialism would have revolutionized everything. And if it started in Germany and been successful, it might have spread to England, to France, to Poland, to who knows where. So it definitely threatened the status quo.
But you have not come across in the English language any studies into this, you know, whether there was a deliberate Freemasonic... I mean, we certainly know that there was a Jewish, powerful Jewish influence in the conduct of this war.
Well, the Freemasons were going to be for the war because Mussolini in Italy suppressed Freemasonry. Hitler suppressed Freemasonry, and Freemasonry became unpopular in Germany. So, of course, the Freemasons are going to be against those regimes. Vichy government in France exposed and suppressed Freemasonry. So, yes, there's an element of that.
There's an element that needs to possibly be explored.
I think there's a lot of research that could be done.
In that direction.
In that direction, yes.
Yeah. Listen, I find that like a never-ending topic. You know, we could lead from one topic into the next.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you sharing your insights with us. And one of these days, when we have that little more research, we will continue this.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.